Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Road to Recovery podcast. This podcast is a platform for education, discussion, and conversations on mental health. I'm your host, Amira Shah, and in this podcast, you'll get to know more about the therapeutic process, insight into life from the perspective of the psyche, and also join me in exploring current issues with other practitioners. I specialize in grief, but I'm always interested in learning about the human experience of the mind, heart, and spirit. So join me on this journey of in-depth learning about ourselves and the world we live in. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Science of the Soul. Today I have with me Natasha Wagner. Natasha is a clinical psychotherapist who focuses on complex trauma. She is also a trainer and facilitator for the Blue Knot Foundation, and she runs her own private practice. Hi, Natasha. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited. We've been planning this for a while, and we're finally here doing this, and I'm just so grateful that you can find time.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
So today we're going to talk a little bit about trauma, complex trauma, which is your area as well. Mm-hmm. So before we begin talking about the theories and how you practice, I'm curious about how you got interested in this space.
Well, it's kind of interesting. I think I always say I accidentally fell into the therapy space. It wasn't somewhere where I kind of had planned to go. I was working, my background is kind of in sales and with a lot of different kind of fashion brands. And in my early 20s, I was in kind of senior management and leadership roles, but I was fortunate enough to get in touch with a trainer who provided a lot of organizational training. And at this time in my career, I was kind of thinking, you know, I don't know what I want to do. I can kind of do my role very easily. Maybe I'll study psychology. Maybe I'll do fashion design. I don't know, where should I go? And this lovely trainer said to me, you know, why don't you kind of meet with this director of training at the institute that I am learning at? Mm-hmm. It was Gestalt Psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. And she said, you know, it would be a wonderful opportunity for you to kind of learn more about psychotherapy. And so in my early 20s, I was very much a type A personality, and I had very little self-awareness, and I went along to meet this director of training thinking I would just go and study psychotherapy, never having been to therapy before or really knowing what therapy was about. And I really remember the conversation that I had with this director, and she said, you know, this is a lot of experiential learning. We do a lot of group work, and in therapy, there might be some things that are going to come up for you, and that can be kind of challenging from time to time. Are you prepared for that? And I remember saying, look, I'm a pretty well-rounded individual. I've got things together, so that's fine. I'll be able to deal with it.
Like, whoa.
Really arrogant, kind of not aware, early 20s, you know, thinking I could conquer the world. And so I went to study therapy. Mm. I fell in love with it. It was challenging. Things did come up, but it changed my world and helped give me a deeper understanding of myself and who I was. And kind of after my first year of training, I was like, this is what I need to be doing for the rest of my life. So that's how I got into it. It wasn't planned or purposeful or intentional, but I think I was kind of guided in the right direction at the right time.
Right direction at the right time. That's the most important thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You were ready and willing to receive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So what are some of the approaches to trauma treatment that you've been exposed to, and why, and what have you chosen?
Mm. So I guess in my initial training, so I trained as a Gestalt psychotherapist, so it was very relational kind of focused approach. And what drove me, I guess, really into the trauma field was probably my own history, but also I think some of the lack of information that comes out of university studies around trauma. So we have kind of like the theory of trauma, but unless you kind of go on to study something additional, you don't necessarily get into, well, how do we actually work with trauma when someone has had a trauma experience or they've had these adverse life experiences? And so I started to look into trauma. I started to read about trauma. I started to attend different trainings, actually attended a Blue Knot training as part of my introduction into this kind of history of complex trauma. And I guess the more I started to learn and understand about trauma, I discovered that not only, you know, do we have traditional methods around talk therapy, but when we're working with trauma, we're working from a nervous system perspective as well. So we need approaches that work, you know, cognitively, top down, I kind of say with the brain, right? There's an important element to that when we're working with trauma around our story and around our behaviors and understanding our emotions. But we also need somatic approaches, or approaches that I would say would be more bottom up, because we're not just working with the event, right? The event of the trauma is over. We're working with the impacts that are left, so the symptoms of trauma, and at a nervous system level. So some of the approaches that I kind of went on to look at in terms of processing trauma, so I studied in sensory motor psychotherapy, which is a body-based therapy. I'm also currently studying somatic experiencing, so Peter Levine's work, Waking the Tiger. In terms of processing, I've trained in EMDR, in brain spotting and havening. Also, I'm certified in Janina Fisher's work, which is a TIST model, trauma-informed stabilization treatment, working very much with parts and fragmentation. And there's probably a lot of other modalities that I could mention, but I think when you talk about treatments for trauma, what works for one person may not work for another. It's individualized. There's no, I believe, one kind of cure-all or modality that works for everything. As Bessel van der Kolk would say, who wrote The Body Keeps the Score, like, we actually need many tools and resources and different modalities, and what is going to be helpful for one person isn't necessarily going to be helpful for another. So it's good to have lots of things to draw from.
So you've trained in all these different modalities, and depending on where you think your client is at or how your client might respond, you choose that modality. That's how you work.
Yes, and I think I work with the three-phased approach. So a lot of clinicians may have heard of this before, but the three-phased approach to working with trauma is kind of like what's considered the gold standard of working with trauma, which is there's an initial phase one, particularly for complex trauma, which is cumulative, repetitive, ongoing trauma, particularly in early childhood. Phase one works on safety and stabilization, which means that when we've had a lot of trauma, we need some basic learnings and skills to be able to manage some of the intense, perhaps, feelings, sensations, or emotions that we feel. You know, our nervous system can be quite dysregulated, and if we've had early trauma, we haven't had it modeled for us how to work with those overwhelming emotions or sensations. So phase one focuses a lot on teaching you skills and resources. There's also a level, I think, of psychoeducation, and I always give a lot of psychoeducation because I believe that when we have the knowledge, it's really powerful, right? When we know what trauma is, when we know the impacts and we can understand it, we've got a level of awareness about it, then we can start to work things. So phase one, safety and stabilization, learning about trauma, learning skills and resources. That's kind of the first beginning point. And there's a number of different, again, modalities we can use to work with that. And then depending on what the person might be looking for, some people will really focus on phase one and they do a lot of work with those impacts. They regulate their nervous system, they feel really good, they manage their symptoms, and then they might go, you know what, I don't know if I want to go back and process those trauma memories or that state-specific event, whether that's an incident of assault or abuse or something else. And I guess this is where it's collaborative. It's really where I'm working with the person. They have a choice about how much work that they want to do. But if we move on to phase two, we often talk about this is where we process state-specific memories or particular events that the person might want to work on. Only after they've done a level of this safety and stabilization work, because they need to be able to, when we go to process memories, have one foot in the present with me in the office, and one foot a little bit in the trauma memory, because we have to activate it to some degree to get the shift. So phase one work is always really crucial and important. And once someone feels ready to maybe address some of those specific memories or different trauma events that happened, we move on to phase two. And then the third phase we call integration or making meaning, because it's kind of not enough just to process the memory. You know, after you've been through trauma events and you've done the safety and stabilization, you've processed the memories to the degree where you might not necessarily have a lot of those trauma symptoms left over, or they're no longer distressing. Phase three is actually really important, because people can start to work on, well, what about the relational stuff? You know, how do I set boundaries? What do I do if I have a conflict with my partner? How do I feel about my own self-confidence or self-esteem? And most importantly, you know, now that I've processed these things and I've been through this journey, what does that mean for me? What does that mean for my life? You know, what does it mean that I actually experienced trauma? And what do I want to do with my life moving forward, now that I actually have space to hope and dream, things that you don't have when you're kind of in crisis, right, or struggling with symptoms of trauma. So that's the general approach of the phases, and they're not linear, even though I've just made it sound like tick one, two, three, but that would be the process that I work with, combining a lot of different modalities and working collaboratively with my clients.
Well, thank you for that. So in the last stage, you're looking at basically creating new narratives and new ways of being in the world from the past experiences. And you can only do that when you can regulate yourself and keep one foot here and one foot in the past. And from that, only you can, then can you make meaning. So I'm thinking more towards post-traumatic growth, which we talked about earlier a little bit, because some people don't get to post-traumatic growth with PTSD and CPTSD, and I'll put a pin in that because I might ask you to tell us the difference between those two things for our listeners. But with I lost my train of thought.
It'll come back to you.
It'll come back to me.
You were talking about post-traumatic growth.
Yes, thank you. So with post-traumatic growth, the literature says that basically you can go there, but that's not always what happens. And so what I'm thinking from what you've just described is that maybe you get through phase one and phase two, but not complete phase three. And so that growth aspect, or post-traumatic growth aspect, hasn't been achieved yet. Perhaps.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, because I think, what does that mean? And it might be different for different people. You know, personally, I would say I think I've been through a level of phase one, phase two. You know, I still have things to work on that I might go and process and go back to phase two. And probably at this time in my life, I am in phase three. But do we ever kind of get done? Is it ever complete? I'm not sure. And I think it's really individual about what growth looks like for the person. But I like your point, I guess, about what you're saying, which is we have to acknowledge the pain, the suffering, and the challenge, which is what I always say about trauma. We can't just kind of toxic positivity it and be like, oh, you've had the trauma, you're so strong, or you've endured and, you know, you're amazing. Actually, no, we need to acknowledge like the pain, the suffering, the challenge, and to be able to process and move through all of that. And then I think maybe comes the gold or the growth or, you know, the meaning from it, you know, because human beings, we need to make meaning of our experience. But that's also not to say that doesn't happen in the beginning too. Sometimes I've had people who come into therapy and they've had really significant events, and they're coming with the question of like, what does this mean? Who am I? How has this impacted me that I've been involved in this? So sometimes we're doing a little bit of that meaning making work even in the beginning. But I think there is a process where you do get to, and you start to reflect on what all of this means for you and your life, which is usually towards later stages of healing.
Yeah, which is why when you said that it's not linear, I think that's one of the key things to think about when we're thinking about trauma work, is that it can jump around. And when someone experiences a traumatic event in life, you can very easily be pushed into a meaning crisis or an existential crisis. So that can start to look at you straight in the face, and you have to deal with it. And sometimes it's difficult to want to answer these questions. They're causing you so much distress, but you have to put them aside to be able to regulate yourself first, and then, you know, go in and out. So this, it's fluid. I like that. And you know what's really interesting? When you were talking about that, the three phases.
Mm-hmm.
It is very, very similar. Almost, yeah, you could they're parallel with the psychedelic assisted therapies, which is predominantly the MAPS model, which is the one I'm referring to, created by Rick Doblin and his team in the US. And same thing, you've got the prep phase, you know, you learn about yourself, the self-awareness, how to deal with your emotions, your sensations. It is top-down and bottom-up, very sensory work as well. And then the middle, well, the second stage would be, like you said, having one foot there and one foot here. So not really making meaning or narrativizing things just yet, but just being in that space of what's going on. And relearning and re-experiencing and seeing things with a new lens, with guidance and all that. And everything's a little bit up in the air. And then the final stage is like, okay, what does this mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah, a lot of things connect when you look at neuroplasticity and trauma work and psychedelic-based studies as well.
Yeah,
thanks for sharing that. Yeah. It was just going off my head.
Thanks for that.
So, yes, PTSD and CPTSD. Can you tell our listeners what the difference is?
Sure. So PTSD, I guess originally, and it's been through a couple of different changes in the DSM, which is the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual, which a lot of clinicians will use to diagnose, originally related to like a single incident trauma, and originally came out of the work with war veterans. And also Dr. Judy Herman, who was kind of one of the female pioneers in the early trauma field, started to look at the correlation or some of the similar symptoms or impacts that women of domestic violence faced. So PTSD was usually thought about, you know, kind of as a war trauma or a single incident event. It wasn't until about 2018, 2019 that the International Classifications of Diseases, which is another kind of model that can be used for diagnosis, introduced the category of CPTSD or complex PTSD. And there are some similarities which speak to giving a diagnosis of CPTSD with PTSD. Mostly it includes some additional things around disturbances within self for CPTSD, which is a negative view of yourself or others, a preoccupation or a fixation on some of the trauma events or memories. The challenge, I guess, is that CPTSD is not recognized in the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual, even though it is in the ICD, the International Classifications of Diseases, and even though it contains some other, I guess, symptom clusters that would speak to someone's experience of complex trauma, which is cumulative, repetitive, ongoing experiences of trauma that happen in relationship, whether that's with an individual or through an institution, for example. It doesn't necessarily fully describe the complexity or the challenges that come with someone who's had a complex trauma history. So I guess in summary, you could say that PTSD we often use to describe a single event trauma. CPTSD we're often using as a diagnosis to describe multiple experiences of trauma and trauma that has an interpersonal element or trauma that's happened in relationship. That's generally what we mean when we say complex trauma. It's trauma that's happened in the context of interpersonal relationships and that is cumulative, repetitive, and ongoing. So there is some, I think, ongoing discussions around having complex trauma or a type of developmental trauma diagnosis included in the DSM. Bessel van der Kolk talks about this in his book, The Body Keeps the Score, that we probably do need to distinguish in some ways single incident PTSD as a diagnosis with complex trauma or CPTSD, or looking at people who might have had more developmental trauma, such as things that are in the Adverse Childhood Experiences study.
ACEs.
Or, ACEs, some of your kind of more emotional traumas or neglect or instances of sexual abuse, for example, if that makes sense.
Yeah. What comes to mind based on your description of the differences between PTSD and CPTSD is the big T and the small T. So would you say that small T is more akin to PTSD and big T, which is chronic ongoing, is more CPTSD? Or is it, or is it the interpersonal aspect that makes it complex?
Well, it's kind of interesting, like, and some people who use those terms like little t or big T, I think it's one way to think about trauma. Mm-hmm. But when it's complex trauma, the main difference is that it's more than one instance. So mm-hmm. it's cumulative, ongoing, and repetitive, and specifically happens in relationships. So we would think about a single incident trauma, could be a car accident, mm-hmm. it could be a natural disaster, it could be a single incident of abuse, right? So something mm-hmm. that does happen in relationship. But complex trauma is something that definitely happens in relationship. So whether that is an individual or, again, like a larger institution, that's when we would consider it more into the CPTSD or talk about people having a complex trauma history, because it's not an event. It's not an event that doesn't include a person, right? Whereas PTSD, we might say, oh, that person had a single incident car accident, or that person, you know, was involved in a flood. And, you know, it's not interpersonal, it's not relational. But it's also, I think, subjective, which means that when we talk about trauma and who ends up developing perhaps symptoms of PTSD or CPTSD, we actually know that when people experience a trauma, it doesn't necessarily mean they're going to develop PTSD, right? There's so many different factors that can contribute to that. And it's subjective in that when we have a trauma event that happens, it's whether or not our nervous system, our body and our brain working together are seeing it as a perception of threat.
Mm-hmm.
And also our normal coping mechanisms get overwhelmed. So, for example, if I was involved perhaps in a car accident and I was hit from behind, but I was kind of okay, right? Maybe I grew up, you know, driving like those little dirt bikes or, you know, really loving, what are they called? Those rally racing tracks that you can go to.
Go-karts,
yeah, right? And so I'm kind of used to being in cars. Maybe I've done some defensive driving courses and I have this kind of impact and I don't actually develop PTSD from it, right? Because my subjective experience is that I was able to effectively manage. I was able to kind of move my car out of the way and I'm okay. But someone else's subjective experience could be that it is even a much lighter impact or car crash and that their perception is that the threat was very high and that it could have been that they were at risk with their life and they might go on to develop, you know, symptoms of PTSD. So it's always about our perception of threat, and that's different for every single person. And I think that's important to explain because people sometimes think, you know, why am I left with these symptoms or impacts? You know, I survived, or it didn't seem that significant. And it's your perception of threat. We know that even seeing something traumatic can leave us with those symptoms and impacts of PTSD, right? Such as vicarious trauma, when we're exposed to trauma material, when we see stories or hear stories, it has that cumulative impact on us, the same as if we were directly experiencing the trauma. So it's not necessarily that a trauma even has to directly happen to us. It's that we perceive threat, and it can also be indirect.
If the threat that we perceive has brings stuff up for us that has happened in the past, and you know, it could be re-triggering, so on its own, without it you'd be fine, and suddenly you see this happening. And I remember just watching one of the documentaries on the shootings at the Taj Hotel, and I've been there, I went there prior to that, you know, I was in Bombay for a holiday, and I was in the hotel. I saw the bullet, you know, the bullets in the wall. But it was only a few years later, after I watched the movie, and given my background, it totally derailed me just watching that movie. For I wouldn't say it was PTSD per se, but it was, you know, it had an impact on me for like a few days. And what's really interesting as well, when you talked about that, was because back in my master's, I did a bit of research and I presented on corporal punishment. Because I'm from Asia, right? It's very normal to get the crap beaten out of you when you're not behaving. And so, because it's so normalized, I was really curious. I'm like, how come here in Australia, it's such a... like child protection gets involved.
Yeah.
When, you know, a kid has been spanked
mm-hmm.
by their parents or whatever. And how, and in Asia, we seem to grow up fine.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's been slapped in the face or, you know, had a slipper thrown at them.
Yeah.
We've seen belts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just like, I don't understand why is the response so different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a bit of research into corporal punishment and pretty much is along what you've just said, which is if the child
mm-hmm.
who's receiving the so-called punishment of being reprimanded
mm-hmm.
or the walloping,
mm-hmm.
if the child is getting that and the child perceives it as, A, I deserve it, I've messed up here,
yes.
I shouldn't have done that and this is the consequence,
mm-hmm.
and B, the beating or the corporal punishment
mm-hmm.
is proportionate to the misdemeanor.
Mm.
So
well, that's the meaning they make of it, huh?
Apparently, this
yeah.
is like based on a lot
yeah,
of
yeah.
a lot of the studies that were done in Vietnam and things
mm-hmm.
like that. And so, if you're a kid and say you stole some cookies that you weren't supposed to eat because it's not cookie time yet,
mm-hmm.
And then you got found out and your mom slapped you,
yeah.
okay, across the face, and that's something you would have expected,
mm-hmm.
you chances are you probably not be so affected or impacted because it's also normalized in your community.
Absolutely.
And society.
Yeah, in your culture.
And however, it does, they do, you do, you still can develop PTSD and CPTSD
yeah.
if that happens over a long period of time and you don't know whether you're doing something right or wrong.
Yes.
You know, if your parents are, you know,
yes,
fickle, or you, one parent might, you know, have a bipolar or whatever
mm-hmm.
it is, and you don't know why you're getting beaten.
Yes.
Or the beating is just, you know, you see this doesn't make sense. I don't understand. You go into pure shock state.
Mm-hmm.
And then that is pretty much abuse.
Yeah.
So I'm just drawing from what you've just shared
mm-hmm.
in terms of that study that I did in that presentation that I delivered.
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting, I guess, the way that we try and make meaning of things, and especially as children, right? So, yeah, it'd be interesting to kind of delve more into the research, but I guess whether or not someone's left with the symptoms of PTSD, right? All of those things, all those different factors, cultural considerations, how much support the person has, the normalization of it in culture would all have an impact. But there's something interesting you said about being able to predict what happens. And we know that some of the research also shows us that we do better when we have some level of certainty with what's coming. So if we kind of know and we expect, and maybe this is the case, right, with children who may have grown up, and, you know, I'm Asian and certainly have some of my own experiences, but if they predict and can know that something is about to happen, they have ways that they can manage that. It's when there's the unpredictability, and I think this is the piece that comes in with complex trauma. If you are growing up in a home where the caregiver is unpredictable, right? And you don't know when that threat is going to occur, then your nervous system is always dysregulated. You're in a state of constant hypervigilance. And this is where we see the development, you know, and the links between insecure attachment, a disorganized type of attachment that comes from my caregiver's frightening towards me and also frightened of me. So I need to both get close to them and attach, but also defend myself.
Yeah.
And that's the link that we see, that a lot of people who've had that experience of complex trauma will end up with the development of an insecure attachment and potentially also CPTSD.
Yeah, that's where the complexity lies.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
So before we move further, can I just ask you if you can briefly in a few words tell us about the Blue Knot Foundation? I've heard about it quite a lot recently. People have talked about it. I could read it off the website, but
yeah.
I'm just going to ask you.
Sure, I'll just tell you about it.
Thank you.
So Blue Knot is the National Centre for Excellence in Complex Trauma. So they do some wonderful work in Australia. They wrote the also guidelines for working with complex trauma in Australia, and also the clinical guidelines for working with dissociation. So they've got amazing source of resource for survivors that you can actually access online on their website. They also provide a lot of that safety and stabilization work I spoke about on the phone for survivors of trauma who may need someone to contact. You can look up their number, but I know it off by heart. It's 1-300-657-380, which I think is a really wonderful resource for anyone who might be struggling and actually might need to reach out to someone but doesn't have a lot of support. Blue Knot do a lot of training for different community organizations around how to work with complex trauma based on the three-phased approach. They also do training for organizations and clinicians on vicarious trauma and well-being so that we can be sustained in doing this work. They do lots of different workshops also on trauma-informed leadership. And they also do workshops with survivors. I really recommend, if you haven't checked them out, check the website out. You can attend lots of different trainings, but there is a wealth of knowledge and resource on there for both clinicians and also survivors. It's an excellent website.
Yeah, I've had a look at it, and I always provide my clients with links to the Blue Knot Foundation. And so what I'll do is, you know, I'll include all this information at the description of this podcast as well, so that our listeners can easily have a link to the Blue Knot Foundation.
Hey guys, thank you so much for tuning in to Science of the Soul. This is a short interruption to let you know that if you or someone you know are in need of more support, you can find me at Road to Recovery on my Facebook page, my Instagram, or my website at aroadtorecovery.org. I hope you've enjoyed listening so far, and now let's get back to the podcast.
So let's talk about integration. Tell us what this means for you and how powerful you think it is in the process of healing.
And when you say integration, do you kind of mean phase three, kind of making meaning or being able to integrate your experiences or something else?
Predominantly phase three, yeah.
Yeah. I think that, and again, I think it's different for everyone because not everyone may get to phase three. As I said, some people will do a level of safety and stabilization work, and they kind of go, you know, that's enough for me. I don't know if I want to go into those memories, and I feel kind of good and I'm doing well and I feel like I'm able to go on with my day to day in a much better way. For people who do decide to kind of do that phase two and process some of the trauma memories, I guess phase three integration work means that you can do a little bit more work relationally. Which means the relationship you have with yourself and the relationship you have with other people. Because sometimes when we're in, crisis, or we're really struggling with some of the impacts of complex trauma, you know, we're concerned with getting by and surviving day to day. We're not necessarily concerned with how do I look at my self-esteem or what is my dream career? Or, you know, maybe I want to address my challenges with boundaries. You know, those are kind of considerations that we might get to work on when we've actually got space and time and we're not actually living in that kind of state of feeling overwhelmed or completely emotionally flooded or completely disconnected and numb. So I think being able to have some of this work of meaning making or integration means we can go a little bit deeper and looking at, you know, what is the relationship I have with myself? Am I able to develop much self-compassion? How do I overcome challenges when I feel like I'm not good enough? Things like looking at imposter syndrome, for example, or perfectionism. Or what about the things that I kind of find in relationships with other people that I struggle with? Or, you know, maybe I keep having this same challenge in my friendships where I keep getting a certain feedback about how I relate with people. And it's really challenging to maintain friendships. Or maybe it's, I feel like I can't say no, right? And I find that I've got, my boundaries are a little bit permeable, and I'd like to be someone who's able to kind of say no or to take care of my own needs first. I think these are the things we can start to do in phase three work that we can't always do in some of the other phases.
And I believe you... Correct me if I'm wrong, it'll be really difficult to explore and delve into integration work if there is no there hasn't been some aspect of ego dissolution that would have happened prior to that, because then otherwise you'd still be in a state where you're quite attached to or rigid about your identity or how you perceive yourself. And when change happens, flexibility is required, and then that self-introspection and all those questions will start coming up. And that kind of is in my experience of it, is an indication for growth and that dynamism, that in and out, kind of going inward and outwards and wanting to wanting to manifest the changes within, or the awarenesses that's been developed within with family members and friends and the community and the society. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think it's a transition, right? Or it's a shift in your identity, because it's kind of like, who am I, you know, with trauma? And when that shifts and change, you start to shift and change, right? When you're able to process things. And I think maybe that's the meaning making or the integration piece, is that sometimes when you've been living with trauma so long, right, you have certain ways of surviving and coping and behaving, and you're a certain person. Like, we're always changing, right? Who I was 5 minutes ago is different to who I am right now. But in the same way, it's kind of like when you're processing trauma and you're working through all these different kind of layers or doing your healing work, you are shifting and changing and growing. And it often means that there's a lot of grief. I think this is the thing we don't always talk about in phase three. At some point, we also face the grief of, you know, recognizing, well, why did this happen to me? Or how could my life have been if I didn't go through this? And what does it mean that I did, right? These are all those big kind of existential or philosophical questions that you spoke about, which do start to have an impact, I think, on your identity, what you believe about yourself, the world, other people, all those kind of bigger questions. And I think it is a really powerful piece, because perhaps this is where maybe we move into those bigger questions of life or spirituality or who we want to be or what is the meaning of life. You know, that's probably a whole nother topic but that's where my mind kind of goes.
Definitely. I'm really trying not to go down that road. But we could watch some Monty Python later around the meaning of life just to scratch that itch. Before I let you go, I am really curious about structural dissociation and trauma parts, and I'd really like to hear you speak about it, if you don't mind.
Yes, so I guess that the theory of structural dissociation comes from a couple of different authors. Nijenhaus, if I'm saying his name correctly, Steele, and Van der Hart. And the theory of structural dissociation kind of looks at, I guess, our brain's natural ability to compartmentalize, given that we're born with both a left and a right-hand hemisphere, and that when we've had early trauma, so childhood trauma, children are predominantly right brain dominant. So a lot of experiences get stored in the right-hand hemisphere of our brain. And then we have our corpus callosum, which is the kind of middle part of the brain, which helps the left and the right to communicate. And what some of the research shows is that for people who've had complex trauma, it takes longer developmentally for the corpus callosum to help that right and left-hand brain integration happen. So there's developmental delays for people with complex trauma. And this kind of evidence points to, or supports, the theory of the theory of structural dissociation, which speaks to how when we've had complex trauma, a lot of those trauma memories, experiences, responses, or behaviors get stored in the right-hand hemisphere of the brain. So a lot of the brain scans show that when someone, for example, is retelling their history of trauma, it's the right-hand hemisphere that kind of lights up. So the theory of structural dissociation basically says we often have a lot of these trauma memories, responses, behaviors that get compartmentalized in the right-hand hemisphere. And we have this left-hand hemisphere, which the authors kind of describe as the part of life that continues to kind of, the part of us that goes, okay, even though I've had this trauma, I'm going to go on with life, right? Even though this terrible abuse happened to me at school, I am going to manage to finish school and get a degree, and then I'm going to find a partner, build a family, go on to have a career. Because what happens with even with trauma or human beings, you know, we have this will to survive and get through it.
Eros.
Yeah. However, that doesn't necessarily mean the trauma didn't have an impact, right? Mm. And so this is where we see sometimes some of those responses or behaviors, as I said, or perhaps triggers for people start to appear later on. An example could be, let's say I had a fairly traumatic childhood and I had quite a few instances of abuse, and let's say my perpetrator might have been female. And then later on in my life, I start a new role and I have a manager who is female, and there's something that reminds me of this original perpetrator, and I find myself getting extremely irritated at work, or I find myself going into kind of like appeasing this person and doing whatever they say, or even crossing some of my own boundaries or working overtime, even though I know that I don't need to be doing that. And what's happening is there's a part of me, right, that is triggered by this. And again, if we link it back to theory of structural dissociation, that is stored in the right-hand hemisphere of the brain. And depending on how severe my trauma was, I may have had to compartmentalize lots of different feelings, emotions, behaviors, and responses. And often we see this in trauma survivors who find themselves, similar to this situation that I described, acting or behaving in ways that don't feel like them, because they have had to split off or fragment some of their responses. So a lot of the literature will describe this as development of different ego states or fragmentation of the personality stored in the right-hand hemisphere. Usually we describe it sometimes as the different trauma responses. So I might have a fight part, a flight part, a freeze part, a part that submits or appeases, or I might have an attached part that wants to kind of get close or seek out others or be in relationship. And we use that language because that's based on the different trauma responses. But basically what this means is that, you know, we've had to have some kind of compartmentalization or fragmentation of our personality where those trauma responses get kind of acted out, and they feel like, that's not me. You know, there's an interaction that happens and I find myself frozen in indecision. And I'm not usually someone who freezes, right? Or I have an interaction with a male colleague and I feel really defensive and I go into fight mode. Or another certain interaction with someone else and I feel like I need to appease them, right? All of these different responses are due to some of the trauma that we might have experienced, and that kind of gets split off but gets triggered in certain situations and contexts. So the theory of structural dissociation says the more significant and severe the trauma, the more fragmentation of the personality in the individual. So in, you know, maybe a single event trauma, we might have what we call primary structural dissociation, which is where the person might have kind of, yep, I'm going on with my life, I've had the car accident, I'm okay, but actually now I'm starting to avoid that road. Or you know what, I don't like to drive over 80 kilometers an hour anymore, because that's what speed the accident happened. And so there's a part of them, we would say it's a part, that is kind of holding some of that trauma memory, response, or behavior. And then we want to work with that to try and resolve the trauma. When we have complex trauma, or as we talked about, people who might meet the criteria for CPTSD, that trauma that happens in childhood, cumulative, repetitive, ongoing, there's much more fragmentation that needs to happen, because there's more trauma experiences, more splitting. So this is where people may develop, for example, if you're in a home with a caregiver who's abusive, but you also rely on that caregiver, you need to be able to fight and defend yourself, perhaps sometimes, but you also need to be able to attach and get close to the person. So that this is also where we see the correlation with borderline personality disorder and complex trauma. Different parts have to develop for you to be able to do different things to manage that situation. And again, we kind of categorize them into fight, flight, freeze, submit, or attach. That's just one way of looking at it, but you can think about it as, it just means that it has been more fragmentation required to kind of work with the trauma. And people don't always understand why they might behave in certain ways or get triggered with certain things. We call that secondary structural dissociation. And this is where we would usually see people with a complex trauma history. From there, we have tertiary structural dissociation, what is now called dissociative identity disorder, used to be multiple personality disorder, previously known as. And this is where the trauma has been so chronic and severe that there's even more fragmentation or splitting that's required, and there is the development of two distinct different personalities, which we would call alters. And alters are not just kind of parts or ego states. They are, my name is Mary, and I am 12 years old, and I hold part of the trauma that happened at 12 years old. I have my own gender, my own identity, my beliefs, the way that I speak. And then maybe there's another alter personality, which could be Adam, and he's 17, and he holds, you know, another gender perspective, belief, and another part of the trauma. And there can be many different types of alters, but the category in DSM really speaks to at least two separate distinct alter personalities. And oftentimes there's a level of amnesia around these other alters or personalities for people. So the way that I kind of think about structural dissociation or dissociation in general when we're talking about personality is that there's a continuum from more whole to more fragmented. And depending on our experiences, we may resonate or fit in either of those kind of categories.
Yeah, so I am getting the sense that there it is on a continuum. Mm-hmm. Of course, what you've just described just takes me to the movie Sybil.
Sybil? Oh, I haven't seen it, but I've heard of it.
Are you kidding? It's on YouTube.
Okay.
I'll show you later. You have to watch it. It's basically the ID, and she's got 16 different personalities. Okay. It's based on a true story. Really awesome. And that's what got me interested into past work. We actually had to watch that for my grad dip in professional counseling with Swinburne.
Okay, great.
Yeah, that was one of our homeworks. I was totally blown away. I think I was just in a daze for like 2 weeks after that. I'm just like, wow, what did I just see? It's very powerful. And it really evokes a strong sense of compassion for you know when you feel compassion and empathy for someone who's going through misfortune, but then you have a different level of compassion and empathy when you can relate to that.
Absolutely.
And when you can relate to that, although you haven't experienced it, but through art, through literature or through movies, it kind of drags you along with it. And so you have a different appreciation. So I think that that was probably the initial spark for me. To work with trauma, but it wasn't awakened until I got to my refugee work later, a few years later. So what was really interesting, and correct me if I'm wrong, based on what you've described, is that when there are multiple ego states that are not integrated with the other hemisphere, the corpus callosum is kind of still being a barrier rather than a mediator. Would there be a higher propensity to expect personality disorders than, you know, when it gets properly fractured?
Can you say that again or in another
Because
way?
You mentioned borderline personality. So yes. I'm thinking about narcissistic personality traits. I'm not even going down disorder, just traits even.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
You know, if you would have been brought up in a household or experience in early life, just unpredictability and abuse or neglect and all sorts of different things with your primary caregivers or teachers, then that is more likely to
lead to personality disorder.
Traits. Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of interesting. I think, you know, it's even a bigger question, like what is personality and how do we develop that?
Yeah, sure.
You know, one of my mentors, who is Dr. Janina Fisher, you know, she would say, what does it mean to have borderline personality disorder? And she would say that is someone who has a very strong fight part and an attached part. You know, that a lot of our, you know, what we see as personality disorders may have that link. And we do see this, right, to complex trauma. Because children are born with a natural temperament. We know that. They have some natural qualities that result in their temperament. But a personality is often developed out of lived experience. So how much, you know, would things be different if we didn't have that type of upbringing or those experiences? So I think it is interesting to look at, you know, the complex trauma history and experiences and whether or not that means that someone would have that diagnosis. because again, it's kind of like a label, isn't it? Mm. And I think sometimes we can tend to pathologize people. Mm. And I know that diagnoses and pathology are kind of important, right? For some people, it's very supportive to have that label. For others, it kind of feels like, well, I'm more than borderline personality, right?
Yeah.
Or I have a complex trauma history. So I think whatever feels supportive for the person is important to go with. And if they resonate with personality disorder, great. But sometimes I think we're also just looking at, you know what, this person has a lived experience of something and how has that contributed to who they are in the world?
Yeah, with the nature and nurture blend and argument.
Yeah, that not what's wrong with you, right? Or what's your diagnosis, but like what happened here?
Yeah, you know? Lived experience phenomenology.
Love it.
And with working with such traumatic cases or people with experiences that, I mean, some of the times I just can't believe what I hear when it comes to what people have experienced and the fact that they're sitting in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you go through this on a very regular basis as well. Have you experienced vicarious trauma as a result? Maybe in your earlier years when you started in this space?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And I think that I really want to normalize vicarious trauma, especially for clinicians working in the field. I teach on this topic, right? So I tell clinicians vicarious trauma is not a matter of if, it's when.
Uh-huh.
You are going to be impacted by vicarious trauma because you're a human being and you have a heart and you're hearing stories of pain and suffering and challenge. That doesn't mean that you won't always be able to do the work, but it does mean you have to have an awareness of it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a term that came out, I think, about 2009 called vicarious resilience by researchers.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah, so the idea is that, you know, as much as we get impacted by exposure to direct trauma material, we can also turn towards things that support us to experience vicarious resilience, like what is the gold in the work, what is the meaning that we get in the work, how do we turn towards people ability not just to survive trauma but sometimes even thrive, right? There are so many trauma survivors, as you said, they're amazing, right? If you work with a trauma survivor and you want to know how to handle adversity, talk to them because they are experts and they're really resilient. And I think it's important that we turn towards the gold in the work as well. Not to dismiss the pain, the suffering, the challenge, that's real. We don't want to override that. But we can support vicarious resilience by being able to turn towards the things that are empowering. The potential for, I think, profound, even spiritual transformation after trauma, or that post-traumatic growth piece, even just someone's ability to survive, is pretty significant. So yes, I always say I have low impacts of vicarious trauma that I manage, and I have things in place. You know, I work 3.5 days a week.
Yeah.
I do supervision. I do teaching to kind of balance out my workload. Yeah. I have a lot of good well-being initiatives and practices in place that help me to support me do the work. But I expect, you know, that there's going to be times when I need to look at my level of vicarious trauma. And I know if I get left with something, I take it to therapy, right? And I process it, or I take it to supervision. Trauma-informed supervision is one of the preventatives we use for vicarious trauma. So yes, we're all going to experience it, but there's absolutely things we can do to support ourselves in working with it as well. I kind of think it's like, it's the cost of doing this work, right?
Yeah, occupational hazard.
Yes, yeah.
But I 100% agree with you, because when I started in the field, I also had a trauma-informed supervisor who really held my hand through it. And I didn't even know that, you know, it was happening to me until I was in bed, and I can actually close my eyes and see what was described. And I'm just like, these aren't my memories. How interesting is that? Like, her stories became my memories. They became my flashbacks. It was so interesting. And I found that for the period of 3 weeks, I was particularly snappy and short, at disrest and unease in general. And that was my first experience of vicarious trauma and understanding what it is. And because it wasn't debilitating, I wouldn't call it hugely profound in terms of experiential level.
Sure.
I could still work and it was fine, but it was prominent enough for me to learn exactly what I needed to learn from it, because it was a lesson, basically. You can't keep exposing yourself to such traumatic content back to back with no resources, no support, no understanding of yourself and around you. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was one of the best experiences, learning experiences as a professional counselor, was to go through vicarious trauma properly at least once. And like you said, low impacts from time to time, but well managed. All these practices in place have just been a lifestyle. It has to be a lifestyle to do the work that you do.
Absolutely.
And the work that we do. So I think maybe we should wrap up a little bit by now. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners for those who might be perhaps living with or in close relationships with people who have experienced trauma?
I think the thing I would say is that if it has been your experience where you've had trauma and it's something that you would like to get support with, and you maybe haven't found the right person to get support with yet, don't give up, right? We know that even though there are some fantastic, there are lots of different modalities that work with trauma, as I said, not one approach works for everyone, but find someone who feels right for you, right? We know that sometimes the biggest predictor of therapeutic outcomes is actually the relationship. So it's really important that regardless of the modality, that the person you find to work with is someone that feels safe enough for you, right? I won't say completely safe because we don't always feel safe, and that can be a triggering word, but feels safe enough and has some knowledge, and you feel there's enough relationship to be able to work with. If you've had therapy before and it hasn't felt like quite a fit, please don't give up. Please continue to do your work if that feels right for you, and find the right person.
And are there any resources apart from the ones that you've mentioned that Blue Knot provides? Are there any other resources that people can look to? Any books, podcasts?
There are some books, I think, and I always advise caution and to go kind of gently when you're reading about trauma, because sometimes it can be triggering as well.
Definitely.
There's a lot of amazing female authors out there too that I like to share. A lot of people already know Bessel van der Kolk, The Body Keeps the Score, and I think that's a good kind of overview, but can also feel like a lot to work through as well. Maybe if you put a link, I have a list of actually recommended reading on my website for people, and also some tools for clinicians who might be interested, and then you can kind of look through and see what books you kind of resonate with. Of course, Blue Knot, as I mentioned, and then I also have a lot of kind of practical resources on my website as well, videos for self-regulation and nervous system stuff as well, so that might be a resource. And if you're looking for a trauma-informed therapist, Blue Knot actually has a list of vetted trauma-informed therapists. You can contact them and get in touch with them as well.
And how can people get in touch with you if they wanted to,
You
know, suss out your resources?
If they can find
watch me. You on Instagram.
You can watch some Instagram reels. But probably online via my website is the best. My name is spelled a bit differently, as you know. I'm sure you'll probably pop that into the content. But natashawagner.com and Natasha Wagner on Instagram are the two places I kind of show up the most.
Yep. And dear listeners, I really, really encourage you to get onto her Instagram, because her videos are really informative.
And funny, right?
And hilarious. And I'm just going to leave it there because I don't want to be a spoiler. But every couple of days I am laughing or just impressed. It's one or the other. Thank you. Thank you, Natasha. Thank you for taking your time to come and see me, speak with me, and share your knowledge.
Thank you, Amira. It's so nice to connect.
I'm going to give you a hug once I press stop.
Yeah.
All right. I will include all the links in the description for Natasha, her resources, as well as the Blue Knot Foundation. Thank you for listening.